This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. The voters in Washington and Idaho have spoken, and we'll review some of the highlights this hour. We'll start in Washington, where Maria Cantwell was reelected as a U.S. Senator. Kathy McMorris Rogers was reelected to the U.S. House of Representatives, and three of four initiatives were approved. Only the carbon emissions tax was defeated. School and library bond issues in Spokane were approved. There are some changes in the composition of the legislature, but not much in the Spokane area, where the incumbents won in all districts, including the 6th. Mike Volz was reelected to a House seat. Representative Jeff Holy was elected to the Senate. And for the only open seat, as we speak, Republican Jenny Graham has a slim lead over Democrat Dave Wilson. How do they fit into the bigger legislative picture? We welcome our Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins to the program.
The Washington legislature was pretty close in both the House and the Senate in terms of the numbers of both. How does that look as we talk right now?
Well, the trend line certainly shows that Democrats are going to pick up some seats, both in the House and the Senate. These are not going to be runaway majorities. They're not going to be super majorities, but they're going to be more comfortable margins than just having a one seat advantage. So in the House right now, Democrats are on track, assuming trend lines hold, to pick up at least 7 seats currently held by Republicans. In the state Senate, Democrats are on track to pick up 2 seats, although one of those races is super, super tight and, you know, might end up being a Republican hold. What we're not seeing is a case where Democrats picked up 4, 5, 6 Senate seats that are currently held by Republicans. This was not a sweep. This was not a wave. This was not a tsunami for Democrats.
And how does that change the way the Democrats might approach what can we get done in 2019?
I think Democrats are going to be certainly more bullish about asserting their majorities, and they're going to want to do things that they haven't been able to do heretofore because of either these very narrow majorities or in recent past years having divided control of the legislature. That said, they're also going to be mindful of overstepping and overreaching. This is something that Speaker of the House Frank Chop, who is a Democrat from Seattle, but I often joke that really he's D. Bremerton because he grew up in Bremerton, and he tends to have a more FDR working class Democrat view of things, and he understands that if Democrats overstep on things like taxes, if they get too liberal, that they can really pay the price in the next election. So I do think things like a capital gains tax is very much going to be on the table. I think Democrats would like to pass a capital gains tax. I think that they will try to pair it, or that if they do it, they will pair it with some reduction in the state property tax in order for there to be an offset. I think we're going to see Democrats talking a lot about health care and specifically prescription drug prices. And because of the failure of the carbon fee initiative, and because this is such a priority of the governor, I expect we'll see Democrats talking again about ways to curb or reduce carbon pollution. Whether that involves putting a price on carbon, I think remains to be seen.
What do you think about education funding? Because as most of the school districts around the state found out late summer as they were negotiating with their teachers, some of those districts would say, we probably gave away too much. We gave too big a raises. And as we look down a year, 2, 3 years down the line, we're going to have holes in our budget that we didn't expect to have.
Certainly when school districts and the union come together and come down here and say, we need some changes in the McCleary solution. We need more money to sustain our budgets and to avoid layoffs in the coming years. They're going to encounter a more receptive audience in Democrats than they would in Republicans. And I think that already we're hearing from Democrats in the State House that there is an intent to try to make some changes. There's definitely the feeling that the property tax hikes in the central Puget Sound region are too much, and there needs to be an offset for them. So absolutely, I think that the education community will find a receptive audience when it comes to additional funding. I will also tell you, though, that there's going to be pressure on Democrats to pay some additional attention to higher ed, which has arguably been neglected in as K-12 education took so much of the room out of the oxygen. And I will also tell you that there is a bipartisan interest in addressing a number of issues, not the least of which is shoring up the mental health system. So I don't think that you're going to see the end of bipartisanship. But again, if Democrats really flex their muscle and kind of pull away from Republicans, then Republicans are going to dig in and they're going to definitely play the loyal opposition and not cooperate.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Is there a Hearst decision type of issue out there that's going to make everything come to a stop unless it is taken care of first?
Well, nothing quite like the Hearst decision involving, you know, water and drilling wells on private property, which, you know, really highlighted the urban-rural divide, which we're hearing a lot of post-election commentary on, that this country is so divided, urban to rural, and that's true in this state as well. I'm not necessarily seeing... So from a political standpoint, I think that urban-rural divide is really going to be on display here, because the Republicans who are losing their seats in the state house tend to be more moderate suburban Republicans. I mean, it's been noted just in the last several hours since the election that Republicans in King County are nearly an extinct species. So you are going to see more conservative Republicans in the legislature and fewer moderates. But I also think that where the tension is going to be and where you're going to see the pushback is around any sort of taxation measures. That will incite the Republicans to really howl. And I also think that you're likely to see anything that smacks of a Seattle-style policy or something liberal Seattle would do will also give Republicans ammunition.
Austin Jenkins is the Olympia correspondent for the Northwest News Network. From one state capital to another now, we bring in James Dawson from Boise State Public Radio to review some of the top-level results from the state of Idaho election. Tell us about Brad Little.
Yeah, so Brad Little, he has been lieutenant governor for 9 years. Before that, he was a state senator since the early 2000s. He's never lost a re-election bid, as we heard from him earlier today, at least when we had spoken to him. And he's just kind of your typical conservative Republican in a typical conservative state. He does differ from his current boss, Governor Butch Otter, just a little bit in certain respects. I mean, he wants to repeal the grocery tax, for instance, that was kind of consuming the state legislature a couple years ago. He also wants to put, a lot of his attention on infrastructure and education, and especially kind of shoring up early childhood literacy rates. He thinks that that's one of the keys to really improving Idaho's somewhat dismal education scores, to be frank, on the national scene. And he also is seen as someone who can work well with Democrats and Republicans alike, and especially within his own party, kind of trying to wrangle those who might be more moderate versus those who are a little bit, but much more conservative than he is even.
So it was an interesting contrast between him and Paulette Jordan, who is the Democratic candidate. She got a lot of attention, not only in Idaho, but around the country for her candidacy. How would you assess, she picked up 38% of the vote, Brad Little almost 60%. How would you assess the way it all finished for her?
You know, that's a difficult question, because political scientists that I've spoken to had kind of wondered whether she was going to break that 40% mark. That was kind of the benchmark that they were going to see as sort of a marker as to just how much she energized voters. And I think that she might have fallen a little bit short of that, given how much press that she's gotten both locally and nationally. But I will say that Democrats did have an interesting night in the legislature. They picked up 4 House seats. They did lose former Representative Jordan's seats in Plummer and Latah County to a Republican. But Democrats also picked up 1 Senate seat, so net 4 seats right now. And then there's one that's too close to call here in Boise, with 6 votes separating the Democrat and the incumbent Republican. So I think that if Democrats wanted to kind of latch on to her presence bringing good news for them down ballot, I think that that might be something that they can hold on to.
So just as Idaho will have a new face in the governor's seat, it'll have a new face in Congress with Russ Fulcher, who won easily in his race. Tell us a little about who Russ Fulcher is.
Right. So Russ Fulcher is a staunch conservative, but he's not really Trump-like in his demeanor. He was a state rep or a state legislator at the Idaho Capitol for a while. He's had higher political aspirations. He kind of famously was going to run for governor here this year. He ran for governor in 2014, barely losing in the primary to Governor Butch Otter. And then kind of dropped out after Congressman Raul Labrador, who is the person who currently sits in CD1, said he was going to run for governor, too. So he decided to go over to the congressional race. But, you know, he's worked at Micron. He's also worked in real estate. And he's very pro-business, very conservative as well. But as I said, not really Trump-like in his demeanor. He's not going to really practice any of the name calling that you hear typically from the White House or anything like that. But he does seemingly represent CD1 pretty well, and he won with 63% of the vote. I mean, his opponent, Christina McNeil, ran an unapologetic progressive campaign, and that really didn't seem to sit well with voters there.
So let's go to one of the other statewide races, and that's the one that's probably the closest, Sherry Ybarra, who is the superintendent of public instruction. For much of the night, she was behind her Democratic challenger and ends up winning. And as we talk right now, it's still a close race, but it apparently has been called. What about that race? Why is it so close?
Well, I think the Democrats really saw this as maybe the one race that they had a really strong chance of winning, and so they put a lot of support behind Cindy Wilson, who is the Democrat in that race. You saw just a litany of endorsements from a bunch of education associations or teachers' unions. You saw that she had raised almost three times the amount of money that incumbent Sherry Ybarra had won or had earned. And it seemingly was where they decided to put their focus this year. And, you know, Sherry Ybarra has had her problems with members of the legislature saying that, you know, she's not showing up for these important hearings or they can't get a hold of her. And it just really didn't seem to matter as much since Idaho is still a fairly overwhelmingly conservative state.
Let's look at the two propositions, which were fairly high profile for statewide measures. Proposition one, the horse racing, the gambling initiative, it went down to defeat. Why do you think it did?
That's an interesting one. I spoke with a political science professor here probably just about an hour ago, and she had said that typically voters, if they don't understand an issue as well, or, you know, they still might have some outstanding questions, then they're more likely to vote no. And maybe that's what happened here. There was also a lot of money that was put into this race. I mean, more than $10 million from both sides. You had the Coeur d'Alene Casino and the Coeur d'Alene Tribe pump in, you know, more than $5 million on their end, plus the owners of Le Bois park here in Boise, they put in another more than $5 million as well to try and get this thing passed. But, you know, it just didn't seem to resonate with voters as much as Proposition 2.
And Proposition 2 was the Medicaid expansion initiative, which you would think in a very fiscally conservative state would be a tough sell, but it more than 60% approval for that. Why do you think so?
Yeah, and that's an interesting one, too, because I followed both of these campaigns pretty heavily throughout the year, and it just really seemed like this is a much more personal issue. You have people who either have personally experienced, you know, whether they were uninsured or underinsured, they've experienced, you know, maybe some medical debt, or people close to them, their family, or maybe some friends, and so they saw the real-life consequences of not being insured or being underinsured. But then also, I really haven't gotten an answer from any of the Republicans that I've spoken with as to why seemingly some of these voters who have been staunch opponents of the Affordable Care Act seemingly have just embraced this unapologetically.
James Dawson is a reporter for Boise State Public Radio. More now about Prop 2. Idaho voters joined voters in Utah and Nebraska in approving Medicaid expansion ballot measures. The proposition in Idaho received more than 60% support. Steve Jackson talks with Emily Strizich from Reclaim Idaho, the organization that carried out the signature gathering process to get Prop 2 on the ballot.
talk for a moment first about, you know, just how important the passage of Prop 2 was for this gap population?
Oh, well, monumentally important to those who are living in the gap. You know, after traveling all around the state and meeting, you know, hundreds of Idahoans who are having to choose between groceries or an asthma inhaler or keeping the heat on in the winter versus going to the doctor to get, you know, your blood pressure medication, this win provides those Idahoans with, you know, the security and the comfort of knowing that they are going to have healthcare access should they need it. So it's a huge win for all of those, you know, residents of Idaho, but it's a huge win for the thousands of volunteers that got involved in this great cause, and a huge win for the voters of Idaho who put, you know, the betterment of the people over, you know, political branding.
Just for a moment, remind me how big that gap population is estimated to be, and then do we think there'll be quite a significant number of other folks who may be able to either get Medicaid or make the transition easier to signing up for ACA?
Yeah, so there are currently 62,000 Idahoans who make under 100% of the federal poverty level. So that is, you know, for a family of four, that's $25,000 a year. We wrote the bill to 138% of the federal poverty line, which is congruent with the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion provision, which really enables people to not just, you know, have healthcare access, but be able to get their feet under them so that they can transition from the Medicaid program, you know, to a plan on the exchange. For example, in Ohio, about a third of the initial enrollees have already kind of unenrolled for Medicaid and have been able to transition onto the state's exchange program. So that's kind of some of the idea around having the bill extend to 138% of the federal poverty level. I think some of the risk of just extending it to 100% of the federal poverty level, what we know from folks who work, you know, at daycares or in the service industry, you know, your hours may vary from 1 month to the next. And so it was a lot of times people are kind of bouncing between having health coverage and not. And, you know, a lot of the idea around the Medicaid expansion is to provide people with a measure of security and knowing that they have healthcare access. So expanding the plan to 138% of the poverty level was important to help provide that security to Idahoans.
What, and then talk a bit too then, so what are the next steps to get the Medicaid in place? Do the legislature have to act, and when? What's the timetable and such?
You know, so I believe the Department of Health and Welfare has 90 days. I think it's about 90 days. And once the legislative session opens again, the state legislature will have to find the 10% funding to the 90% federal match. Sean Keogh, a Republican senator from up here in Sandpoint, who is on the JFAC committee, has said the money's there. It's just a matter of allocating it. And again, the savings to the catastrophic fund will be able to cover the 10% funding. So that's just going to be, I think, the only fight that we have is really just this question of where the funding's going to come from. You know, there were a lot of legislators elected last night who said they would actively work to oppose the will of the voters. So I think the will of the voters spoke pretty loudly last night. And so we need to keep the pressure on those legislators that that people want more health care, not less. And that people really want a common sense solution to this Medicaid coverage gap, not this continued like political football that's been played over the past 6 years.
Emily Strizich is from the group Reclaim Idaho. Spokane City and school district voters have committed themselves to paying for new schools and libraries. A $495 million school bond issue and a $77 million library bond issue both received more than the 60% approval they need for passage. There was a third ballot measure tucked in there, too, an advisory vote related to the siting for a new sports stadium for which the school bond issue will pay. 65% of voters picked the current Albee Stadium site over a downtown site. More now as we talk with Associate School Superintendent Mark Anderson about the school-related measures.
I want to start with the advisory vote. What was your thought when you saw that 65% of the folks, at least in the first count, had decided that Albee was the place they wanted to see the stadium?
Well, as I've been out making presentations across the community, I wasn't totally surprised because there is a lot of sentiment still left with Albion. Folks tend to be more comfortable with the familiar, and that was an option, of course, that was the school district's first option, was to downsize Albion and right where it was and to be able to build a new middle school. So though I think there was a lot of compelling reasons that was brought out during the last 6 months about the opportunities of having a stadium downtown and the opportunity actually to expand Merkle Fields, where the old stadium sits, was compelling, but apparently not compelling enough for a majority of voters who got to weigh in, which was an important part of the process. We wanted to hear from voters.
So obviously the school board is the one that has the last decision on this. So where do you go from, assuming that this stays more or less at 65 or even 60, right, where do you go forward with this?
Well, we'll have a discussion, of course, with the board and our project schedule for doing it. But I think the board will listen to what voters were saying as well, unless something new comes along that we're not aware of that maybe changes the impact or opportunity. So,
is Albion in a sense easier than building downtown because you've already got the, you know, a lot of control out there?
Well, I would have to say yes and no. To phase Albion and be able to continue to play sports there, that makes that project more complicated in that we'll have to do a phased downsizing approach in order to have a field to continue to play on. So that's a con to the Albion. Easier as far as less complicated. We're familiar with it. We can build our own parking there along with the middle school. Don't have to come up with agreements with other agencies and so forth. It'll just be us doing it. So that makes it a plus. Where the downtown, we would have cooperated with the Spokane Public Facility District to build it there and then have them operate it for us. There's advantages to that. That's the business that they're in, is operating large facilities. So that was appealing to us to have them take over operating and running the stadium. And then they could use it for lots of other purposes. But I would say weighing the pros and cons, yeah, it's probably simpler at Albion for the school district because we have control as one entity in replacing the stadium and building that new middle school.
So given all the other projects you have in that bond issue, and it's a pretty considerable list, where does this fit in terms of that six-year plan? Is it a fairly urgent project, or is it a few years down the line?
So the stadium actually would be early in the projects because we need to get it downsized so that we can build that middle school on the parking lot. So it would be one of the early. We're planning to do the north side schools, both the replacement of Glover and Shaw and the addition of a new stadium or school at Stadium and a new school at Foothills during the first 3 to 4 years of the bond, so that we can move all of the north side sixth graders up into middle schools. Then we'll do the replacement of SAC and the new South Hill Middle School in the second phase of the six-year plan.
So you're giving us a feel for sort of what's next now that this appears to be. But what do you do in terms of finding the money? Is it selling bonds? What goes next for you?
So we will have been authorized by the voters to sell up to $495 million worth of bonds. We won't sell them all at once. We will sell them in portions as we need the money to do the projects. So we'll probably have 3, 4, maybe even 5 bond sales over the next 6 years. We also try to control looking at what assessed property is doing so that we kind of keep the promise to voters that their taxes won't spike going up and down and so that there's kind of this steady tax rate that they can have for their school construction bonds.
So how soon do you start moving on that project of raising that first batch of money?
So we actually will sell in January because Shaw is first out of the chute. We're already in the master planning for Shaw, along with the Hilliard Library moving onto that campus, along with the On Track Academy. So that'll be the first set of projects. Out of the 2015 bond, we actually are going to bid the Lewis and Clark High School, both the addition, which we already had in the 2015 bond, and their new cafeteria this winter. And it'll actually start construction this spring.
So you'll be doing two projects at one time from two different bonds.
Correct. And plus Wilson. Elementary. An 8-classroom addition of the 2015 bond at Wilson. It'll start this spring as well.
Mark Anderson is the associate superintendent at Spokane Public Schools. Washington U.S. Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers won a decisive victory Tuesday in defeating her Democratic challenger Lisa Brown. On election night, McMorris Rogers had a 12 percentage point lead in a race many thought would be much closer. Here are two moments from their respective election night gatherings.
It was a battle. I stand before you tonight stronger, better, and more convicted in what we are fighting for. We are fighting for freedom. We are fighting for opportunity for all. We are fighting for free markets and more jobs, more opportunities for all. We are fighting for self-determination.
I know our country may seem awfully divided right now, but I want you to know that our armed services members have died and risked their lives for the freedoms we enjoy as Americans, and that courageous people throughout our history have marched and risked their lives and bravely shared their stories and stood up for themselves and their families so that women could vote, so that African Americans could vote, so that Native Americans were not forced into boarding schools. That's what this country really stands for.
Jeremy Burnham covered the Spokane Republican gathering Tuesday night. Jared Brown was with the Democrats. I asked them about their most powerful impressions from those election night parties. Jeremy first.
There was a lot of excitement and a lot of, you know, team building behind the Republican flag. They opened with a prayer where they asked God to help them take down their enemies. And that was kind of interesting because I realized in that sense, their enemies were Democrats. So I was a little kind of surprised by that. But there was a lot of, you know, talking about gathering around other like-minded people. For a Republican rally, it was very feminist. Kathy McMorris Rogers had the Kathy Represents Me women behind her. They came up. There was a time where, you know, there was 25 people on stage when she gave her speech and it was all women. And there was a lot of celebrating that she is now the most powerful, highest ranking woman in the United States government. So there was a lot of talk about that. And there were a lot of female politicians or people who are in the state and supporters of her that talked tonight. So
okay.
Very female powerful rally.
Okay. So anything really strike you, Jared, when it came to the Democrats?
Yeah, kind of the array of people that showed up. I expected a lot of young people, of course, but there were a lot of old people there. There were a lot of veterans for Lisa Brown that showed up. One of the most surprising things to me was the amount of support for specifically Robbie Catherine Anthony out of all of the candidates. When she came on to give her speech, people were cheering her name and chanting when she wasn't right in the room.
Robbie is a transgendered woman and yeah, running for county commissioner.
Yeah, Robbie would have been the first transgender person to hold Spokane County office and won in a wide margin in the primary, in the district-only primary, and then didn't do as well in the countywide general election.
Jared Brown is a student at Gonzaga University. He's our current intern. Jeremy Burnham is our immediate past intern. He's a student at Eastern Washington University and managing editor of the Easterner newspaper. Inland journalist Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. You can hear the entire program or segments of it online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. We appreciate your support both with your ears and your wallets. I'm Doug Nadvornik.